Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, I've actually decided on a topic this week because... Because what I've decided to do is, you know, and very often when I decide on a topic, it's something a little bit cynical. It's designed to push one of my other projects. I'm not going to lie, that does happen. But as you can imagine, as writer-director of The Last Airship, there's no way I can possibly be cynical in my suggestion that we cover pre-aeroplane flight in this particular episode. There's no way at all that balloons or anything else are going to be coming up when we have this particular discussion.
Well, you say that, but interestingly, I do have somebody who had nothing to do with balloons, but is absolutely relevant to this particular discussion. But I take your point, and I'm dying to know about... I mean, I think most people have heard about the Montgolfier brothers, but when the first Zeppelin was, or airship, or so, or something like that, that will be interesting to hear from you. So, because you've done a good introduction, you picked the subject, where do you want to start?
I want to start way back... In ancient times, because one of the interesting things about flight for me is that there are so many things when we look at history that either people haven't really been able to conceive of, or that people have really, really wanted to be able to do, and therefore they focus and somebody's come up with a way to do it, you know, relatively quickly, or at least a progress towards it. And yet when we're talking about flight... This was something that we know certainly as far back as ancient Greece. You know, we have myths of flight. We have myths from around the world of things like magic carpets. Flight was always this aim, always this goal. People would watch the birds. They'd see them fly. We have the expression flying too close to the sun. And that comes right back from an ancient Greek myth. And even in that ancient Greek myth, you know, this idea of Icarus with his wings stuck on his arms, his feather-coated wings to make him like a bird, people actually had a very, very basic concept of flight that with a bit of, you know, sort of work and just that extra final push of inspiration, that final push of knowledge could have led to an aeroplane. You know, people had the idea of, you need to stick wings on something. Now, obviously, making an aeroplane is far more complicated than that. In fact, I recommend a wonderful audiobook series. I don't know if you've ever heard of a series called Cabin Pressure, Jem.
Oh, yes. Yes, I absolutely love it.
Cabin Pressure. This is John Finnemore wrote this series. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch. And there is this wonderful episode of that where one of the characters wants to know how planes fly. And they all sort of try and explain it, that there's lift and thrust and drag. And you get to this wonderful moment where one of the pilots says, well, what happens is it's got to do with the shape of the wind and the airflow over the wind. And because of the way a wing is shaped, it pushes the air up and over the top and it goes underneath. And so that is what makes the aeroplane stay in the air. And the character is asking the question and says, well, is that why planes can't fly upside down? And the other character says, well, of course they can fly upside down. And, well, how does that work then? Because the plane's flying. And you suddenly, when you start to look into questions like that, and I was listening to this, re-listening to that episode the other day, and it just triggered the thought in my mind, I have absolutely no idea how a plane actually flies. It sounded like such a silly question. And I could have got all the answers they put in the episode. And then it gets to this one extra question, you go, hold on, no, actually, I don't really understand how a plane flies. I just know they do. If we, you know, if I suddenly got dropped back into ancient Greece now and there's Icarus sticking feathers on his arms, I could say to him, don't be silly, stop sticking feathers on your arms. That's never going to work. And when he says, why not? I wouldn't really have an answer. So one of the things that fascinates me is we've had this dream of flight for thousands and thousands of years. Who knows how far back it really goes? And yet the actual development of the plane certainly comes so far forward. And yes, I know we can bring in things like Leonardo da Vinci's helicopter, such as it was. Guess what? It never actually flew, okay? Things like that never actually flew. So, Jem, I've kind of set us up with a deep philosophical view of flight. Have you got something you would like to start us with?
I'll start you in a moment, but what you just said about the, if you like, the philosophy of this all is about 18 months ago, we actually did a podcast called The History of Flight. Now, we concentrated on airplanes in that situation, and that was a point where I was lucky enough, I'd got a four-month contract working with British Airways, and they have an internal museum, and it just started me getting me thinking about, oh, this is interesting, blah, blah, blah. But we both agreed that there's nothing more, of all the areas of history, there's nothing more fundamentally romantic than the idea of flight. And I couldn't agree more. It seems to me, we don't know this for a fact, but this feels right, that pretty much since the time human beings could look up in the air and think, we weren't even human beings at that point, I think there's always been a desire to rise up into the air, to swoop around with the effortless ease of a bird or something like that. And I think that's always been there. And I think when you're talking about ancient, I thought, oh, he's going to go to China, because there seems to be some evidence they were able to build really large gliders, like really large kites, I should say, that were big enough that could hold a human being. But they would obviously be tethered to the ground. It'd be dependent on the wind. And they would, you know, they did militarize them from the point of view of it was a spotter's thing. You know, they could rise up into the air, have a look where the enemy were, how many they were, and perhaps come on down. But that is pretty, it's clever, it is undeniably clever, it's smarter than anything anybody managed to do in Europe for thousands of years, but, you know, it is also pretty limited as well in terms of its purpose and use and abilities, and obviously it couldn't be used as a form of transport because you're kind of tethered to the ground as well. So, everything you've just said, I agree. Do you want me to give you an example or of somebody?
Yeah, go on. You carry on with an example. Go
so this
it.
Actually, I've had a bit of a flurry of dealing with sort of companies to do with aircraft. There's a company that deals with Antonov 124s that I work with, and if you don't know what that is, I believe it's the largest, heaviest aircraft in the world. I think there are potentially perhaps slightly bigger ones with wingspans, but they're all experimental. But this is that gigantic aircraft which flips up the front, so you could in theory just insert a massive tower straight into it. It can carry about 140 tons of whatever you want it to carry, and that, you know, it's almost like a shipping container type thing in the air, which is unheard of. You airplanes generally can't carry a lot, because the whole point about flight is it's you know, you've got to be light, as it were. But anyway, one of the guys there was a real enthusiast and introduced me to Percy Pilcher. Have you heard of him?
I haven't, no.
Okay, so Percy Pilcher, Englishman, lived in the sort of like the very late Victorian era, and he was Britain's most foremost experimenter of glider technology. And he was able to create all kinds of gliders that obviously they had their restrictions, but he could get them to fly in the air. And he, in 1899, at the age of 33, was able to stick a two-stroke engine on one of those, and on the ground, got it working. And he recognized it had enough lift potential to carry him. But he needed, you know, he needed more money to experiment with this stuff. And so he got people in a field, and he wanted to show it in principle. But at that point, the engine was broken, so he couldn't show them that. So instead, he got into one of his gliders, and it was a rubbish day weather-wise, and he knew it was touch and go on whether he should actually fly. But he needed to show them something, because he needed the money. He needed to get some wow factor, a bit of razzmatazz, yeah? And unfortunately, as he launched into the air, he basically the weather got the better of him, and he crashed to the ground and died. And most people in sort of the aviation history said Pilcher was basically there. If he hadn't have crashed, he probably would have invented heavier-than-air flight round about 1900, you know, beating the Wright brothers by only a matter of years. And the Wright brothers weren't some kind of scientific geniuses. They ran a bicycle repair shop, okay? And then they had this dream, and well done, they did it. But actually, Pilcher had, you know, potentially the money, certainly the expertise, and he could have got there first. But so it shows you, a little bit like something like the four-minute mile. You only remember the one who actually did it in the end, but actually there were a number of people who could have done it, but history has remembered the people, not the theoretical winners, but the actual winners. So Percy, if you like, is my contribution to this, and if you haven't heard of Percy Pilcher, he's one of these kind of great unsung heroes, and the more you look into him, you think, yeah, he's quite the man, isn't he? And he's got a slightly silly but very British name as well.
I like that as his, you know, final thing. When he had his obituary come out in the Times, I do like to think that that should have been the last line. He also had a very British but rather silly name. I think that would have gone. But this idea of gliders is fascinating because I've talked about Icarus and the sticking feathers on your arms, and you know the fact that in that particular myth he flaps his arms and he manages to fly up to the sun and they melt, and he comes crashing down to the ground. And the thing about that is, well, okay, that's fine, but surely nobody actually tried that. Well, of course they did loads and loads of times through history, and we actually have a lot of records of people trying to create gliders, people trying to do what were referred to at the time as tower jumps. And you can actually see these days, there's a modern version of these. A lot of peers around the country have sessions, and I'd say don't try this at home, but what I will say is don't try this at home unless you're specifically entering an event where this is the point and they have all of this safety equipment and everything else that's available and you really understand what you're doing. But you may have seen on TV, I know there's at least a couple of places around the country that do it, where people do build their own handmade gliders, as it were, you know, all sorts of crazy and silly designs. And the idea is that they jump off the end of the pier and the winner is the one that managed to glide the furthest. And if you ever get a chance to YouTube this, it's quite funny because half of them are ludicrous, clearly never going to fly. And yet people always seem a little bit surprised when they jump off the pier and fall splashing straight into the water. Yeah. And some of them are actually quite clever and do actually work. But this does have a long history. We have way back in the 1st century AD over in China, we have one of the Chinese emperors actually had a scout who was bound with bird feathers and claimed that that scout managed to glide over 100 meters. Now, that is completely unsubstantiated. I think possibly more myth than anything else. But we have, you know, a recorded tower jump then. We've got one from 599. But really, one of my favorite tower jumps happens in 1010 AD. So we're still, you know, 900 years before the Wright brothers and their aeroplane or anything else like that. We're still 700 years, nearly 800 years before the Montgolfier brothers and their balloon. An English monk, of all things.
I heard about this. Yeah,
Elmer
yeah,
of Malmesbury. Yeah, decided he'd strap himself into a... He actually created a glider of sorts and jumped... I mean, the description I've got in front of me uses the word flew. I suppose that's fair enough. It's that question of...
Flew rapidly in a downward direction.
Well, not that rapidly, but I think it does remind me of that Toy Story line, that's not flying, that's falling with style. Because he did jump off the top of Malmesbury Abbey, jumped off the top of the tower. Now, you've got to be a fairly brave man just to do that in your own homemade machine. But he did actually fly over 180 metres before he landed. I mean, landed is a technical term. He broke both his legs. The term crash may apply slightly better. But he did manage to fly that distance, cover that distance, before he came down. And he even put down that the problem he'd had was that he hadn't added a tail to the machine. So even though he hadn't made that jump, he had broken his legs, he did spot the flaw in his design and something that could have been repaired. Now, again, this comes up to this question of if flight is so important, and we've both agreed that it kind of is this big thing, why did it take so long for us to get to this situation where people were actually, you know, he's got the basic concept there. He's jumped, he's gone 200 metres. Why did it take so long to carry on and actually design gliders that work properly?
Because of all the deaths and broken legs. You know, the technology wasn't quite there. But on that point, do you know about Franz Reichelt?
No.
Well, you've just reminded me there. I had to just quickly Google up his name again, but I absolutely know the incident. So Franz Reichelt, this is sort of turn of the century, just before World War One. He was an Austrian guy, as you can tell with the name Franz Reichelt, but he earned a living being a tailor in Paris, okay? And he invented the parachute coat. Part coat, part parachute. And he was so convinced that this would absolutely work that he said, look, I'd like to do a demonstration off the Eiffel Tower. And the authorities went, yeah, But what happens if it doesn't work? And he goes, oh, that's fine, I'll use a dummy. So we'll test it with a dummy first. And the French authorities went, okay, that sounds reasonable. Yeah, let's see if this works. It could potentially save lives. You know, could actually be safety equipment on the Eiffel Tower when people are painting it. So he went up, not all the way to the top, but to the first platform. And if you've been to the Eiffel Tower, even that's quite a long way up. But he lied. He was so convinced that his coat parachute would work. A dummy was not thrown off the side. He jumped using the coat parachute, and it didn't work, is the simple answer.
Yes, that, so I can see why we've got the problem coming in. And as you say, it's this question of, yes, it failed, and yes, somebody died. And that is certainly a reason why that person didn't try again. But the history of humanity has not been one of, you know, somebody's killed in the attempt, let's stop. You just look at, you know, sort of capturing the Arctic or, you know, getting to the Antarctic and all of these different things. A number of people that push forward. It does just fascinate me that when people were coming up with the basics, and like you say, even a parachute coat, I believe, you know, we sort of have variations along that theme now that actually are functional. Don't try it with your own coat at home. But the fact that it took us that long, despite the fact we were so close at every step of the way, the fact it took us that long to take the next step. But, Jem, obviously you did ask me at the beginning about dirigibles or airships, the great airship of our time. Now, I'm not going to go into balloons. You've mentioned them on Gaultier Brothers. If people want to look at a balloon, there's lots of history about the balloon. There is, as always, controversy. Anytime we say this is the first person to invent this, it's really the first person that demonstrated it in a satisfactory manner. I think that's the first thing you've got to say quite fairly.
Yeah, yeah, it can. There's all these sort of like slight caveats, but it is worth mentioning that the Montgolfiers were doing this before the French Revolution. I mean, we aren't talking about the Industrial Age or something like that. It really was very impressive what they were able to do. But obviously all they could do, you know, they heated up the balloons, and as the hot air cooled down, it went down again. There was no way to steer them. It was a really interesting, shall we say, proof of concept, but it didn't really do anything other than that.
Fair. In the same way that when we talk about the first aeroplane, we talk about the Wright brothers. We don't talk about the first glider. What we're actually referring to when we say the first aeroplane and we say Wright brothers is the first sustained powered flight. So, when we're talking about an airship...
And just on one that... So, I apologise for interrupting, but I just always love this fact that you could do... If you stripped out the interior of a Boeing 747, you know, a jumbo jet, you could, in terms of the height and distance of what... and the size of their aircraft, you could actually do the Wright brothers' flight inside a Boeing 747. So, that shows you that they didn't go that far off the ground, and, you know, their aircraft was quite small, so... You know, apparently you can do it there, but you'd have to strip absolutely everything out. You couldn't do it with all the seats. But I apologise, I interrupted. Back over.
Oh, no, not at all. Because I was about to ask you a question, actually, because we're going to go on to the first dirigible. And for me to be a proper dirigible, it's got to, one, have a balloon, and two, it's got to be powered. It's got to be able to move. It's got to be able to steer. Now, When you were younger, or with your kids, have you ever done that thing of getting a helium balloon or a kite, although we're not really on kites, getting a helium balloon and tying an action figure onto it to see that action figure float up in the air?
Never a helium balloon, because I was always worried about losing my action figures. I did it with parachutes, like homemade parachutes with action figures, but I take your point. So what happened to little Greg's toy?
No, little Greg's toys are fine, because I was cleverer than you think, Jem. Now, you thought I'd been stupid here, Jem. No, whenever I did this with a helium balloon, I did it indoors, because I didn't want to lose either the action figure or the balloon.
No, I did do that indoors. Sorry, yeah. I thought you were talking about outside.
Yeah, no. Just to get... Right, so you can kind of picture this helium balloon with a man just basically dangling underneath.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, good. If you can picture that, then let me introduce you to the Gifford dirigible, which is essentially what I've just described. Although, it's obviously slightly better than that. We're way back in 1852, and if you picture that classic dirigible shape, that the shape of the Zeppelin, that very long, almost sausage-shaped dirigible, well, you're pretty much on a line for what the balloon looked like. That carries right on through. It's an aerodynamic shape. And that is what the Gifford dirigible, the actual balloon element of it, looked like. And then coming underneath it, you had a whole series of ropes going down to a single spot in the middle, which was where the pilot sat. And the pilot sat there with a steam engine. And that steam engine provided about 3 horsepower of power to actually get this machine moving. And so they filled up the balloon, they set off, and he actually tested this in Paris, and he actually flew 17 miles within Paris that particular day that he tested it, showing the whole thing off. It took him about 3 hours. He demonstrated that he could actually turn and everything else. Really was a fantastic proof of concept. The only slight problem that he had was he had originally tended to get inside the pilot seat, fly the airship that 17 miles, turn around and fly back. Now, what he found out very quickly was that a 3-horsepower engine isn't enough to power an airship against the wind. As soon as there was any wind blowing in the other direction, he kept blowing backwards. Now, there is obviously, you know, that slightly cynical side of you that suggests that the fact he covered that distance with the wind behind him slightly lowers the amount to which it was a completely powered flight. But he was steering as he went. He could turn the airship and everything else. The actual airship itself was about, I think it was about 100 meters or so. 44 meters, about 150 feet long. So this is a great big airship, relatively big airship for just transporting one person at what is slower than a walking pace across the city of Paris, and then only if you've got a good tailwind. But this was the first powered flight of any sort. This was the moment, I think, when we go from, you know, we've always wanted to fly, oh, we can jump off a tower and we'll just crash down and we carry on from that to, oh, we can get a balloon and go up in the air and then come down, to, now I can go up in the air and I can tell the balloon where I want it to go. Now, I can't do that perfectly. That would take time. But I think that that is the crucial moment when man really starts to get the hang of flight. It's that moment where we can actually control the direction of flight. And that's why I think that, sadly overlooked actually in history of flight, Gifford, but you can see a model of this, of his dirigible actually at the London Science Museum, if you get a chance to go up there at any point in time. But yeah, do get along, do check that out if you get a chance, because this is, as I say, the first time that man really controlled flight.
I find that really interesting, that basically what you're pointing out is for 100 years it was France that was at the forefront of flight. And indeed, I seem to recall that in World War I, while, you know, there's the Royal Flying Corps, and the Germans obviously had their planes as well, but the French had a significant aviation industry, and maybe they weren't the number one anymore, but they were certainly one of the major players. But because the Wright brothers in America basically invented the airplane, and you know other things going on, France isn't really remembered as the innovator to do with flight. Which, you know, you've absolutely sold me on that, Greg. I like that. That's a good little find. If I may, though, I'm going to test your language skills now, if you don't mind.
Okay, yes. Very quickly, we're moving towards the end of the episode, so we're going to finish up with a language test for Greg.
Yes. Do you know what the Gesellschaft zur Förderung der Luftschifffahrt is?
I believe what that means is the second star to the right. Is this a reference to fairy dust?
Absolutely not. No.
Worth a shot.
Nice try. Look, why not? Why not go for it? It stands for the Society for the Promotion of Airship Flight. Care to guess who founded it? The clue is the language that I chose.
Yes, I've got that much. Somebody that founded, somebody that's about flying, somebody that's French.
No, that's German. That's absolutely German.
I know, I was being a tad facetious there.
Sorry there, Greg.
Was it Kaiser Wilhelm?
Oh, you're going to kick yourself. It was Count Ferdinand Von Zeppelin.
I should have got that one.
Yeah. So what I found interesting is, because we, you know, you mentioned dirigible. I thought that was an English word, obviously. When you say it, dirigible, it's clearly French. But yeah, I thought that was the British name for it. But I then thought Zeppelin. So, you know, I did obviously look at, you know, Count Zeppelin. And what's interesting is, this is a man who clearly was obsessed with flight. And even though the French had got there first, he was trying to get serious government backing, not to turn Zeppelins, as we now think of them, as war weapons of war, but really more sort of in terms of transportation and specifically postal service, you know, getting shipping and transportation. I find that really interesting that you know, you tend to think of them as kind of warlike. Absolutely not. And, you know, that's another whole area of air flight and aviation. And recently, over the weekend, full disclosure, I was at the Battle of Britain bunker in Uxbridge. And this was basically during the Battle of Britain, the whole of Britain was split into five different areas. This was the one that dealt with the southeast. And to give you an idea, out of all the shooting down of German aircraft in the Battle of Britain, about two-thirds of them were done out of this bunker in Uxbridge. And it's recently been reopened, and it's got a brilliant visitor centre, and you get a tour around it, and you get to see the original table, and they've preserved all the like little flags and things like that to show the incoming enemy aircraft and all this kind of stuff. And that shows you obviously the negative side of aircraft and aviation. But in that, it pointed out, and people forget this, London and Britain as a whole was bombed in World War One. Loads of Zeppelin raids came over Britain, and actually later on, the Germans actually had something called a Gotha heavy bomber, and that was actually an airplane which suddenly wasn't being pushed around by the wind, and those caused far more destruction than the Zeppelins. But imagine, you know, bombers are relatively small. Zeppelins are quite big. Imagine opening up your window and you see these sort of cigar-shaped things in the sky in like 1915, and suddenly bombs start going off. I mean, that's science fiction. That's War of the Worlds type territory. Now, I know I've sort of put things on their head right at the end here, and I know this is going to be a relatively short one. Sorry, everybody. But any final thoughts on that? And I guess we then have to wrap things up.
I think I'm going to leave it there, actually, Jem. I think that is a wonderful place to finish up. I like the fact you finish on a slightly science fiction-y movement, because obviously the question is, if we've spent this long trying to figure out flight and it's only really in the last couple of hundred years that we've got the hang of it, the question is, what is the next thing that mankind has been dreaming of for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years that we will suddenly find out is actually possible after all in, you know, in our lifetimes in the next couple of hundred years? But we don't have time for philosophy now, Jem. What we do have time for is your plug.
Ooh, okay. Let's see. What am I going to plug this time around? I'll just say Neon. It's nice and short. Neon. Got to do another podcast. I know it's been mentioned a few times. If you like this one and you like my voice, you might want to check that out. Sorry, it's just me rather than Greg. Take a piece of pop culture and then reveal the real history behind it. A recent favourite was Predator. Can't get much more pop culture than Arnold Schwarzenegger in a jungle with muscles. I end up talking about the American war against Spain and the American war in the Philippines. So I talk about jungle warfare generally with Americans and not necessarily just Vietnam. The Americans seem to be a little bit obsessed with fighting in jungles. Anyway, that's my plug. Over to you.
And I'm going to plug... I think I'll plug Curious Aquatica, which is my new series of conservation shows. If you go to curiosaquatica.com, that's CURIOSaquatica.com, then you can find out all about those. We're also currently with that raising funds for the Marine Conservation Society of the United Kingdom. If you go to that website, you can find a little link if you do want to drop a few pounds to the Marine Conservation Society to help clean up the oceans around Britain. But that is all for us for this week. So thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Dadoochu.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And don't forget, we got a Fast Five on Friday. But for now, goodbye and take care.